It is Wednesday, December 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at President-elect Donald Trump's transition so far. On the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, we hear from a survivor. And a Danish band is getting increasing attention for their songs about family relationships. It's all ahead. President-elect Donald Trump says former critic and 2012 Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney is still being considered for Secretary of State, reinforcing reports that Romney remains the leading contender for the position. Trump said he will likely announce his choice for the nation's top diplomatic post next week. Well, Romney is just one of many prominent officials who have visited the president-elect at the Trump Tower in New York City. I spoke with Mark Rozelle, dean of the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and asked him about the parade of potential appointees to the Manhattan building.
It's a unique process, there's no doubt about that, and we have not seen a president-elect conduct a transition process like this before, a lengthy interview process of candidate after candidate for various cabinet positions. Now, to be fair, in the past, it has taken some considerable time for some presidents-elect to choose members of their staff and their cabinets. So the timing is not all that unusual. The fact that it's taking a while to name a Secretary of State, for example, or some other top officials is not out of the ordinary, but it's really the open process, the people coming to Trump Tower as though they're auditioning for the job, which has created kind of a media circus and made it seem like a reality TV event to many people, which is something, of course, that Donald Trump had done in his past.
Yeah, and certainly Trump is, he enjoys using Twitter. And there was a famous photo of him having dinner with Mitt Romney, who's one of the people being considered for Secretary of State. You know, and I believe they were having dinner in the Trump Tower. But yeah, there's certainly the optics of this. And also just recently, the other day, you had former Vice President Al Gore, who, of course, was once running for president back in 2000. He had a meeting with Trump's daughter, Ivanka, but I guess eventually Trump participated in that as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we have to keep in mind that Donald Trump has always been a master of mass media. He's always been very, very good at drawing attention to himself and keeping himself before the public, you know, even before he, of course, ran for public office. And much of what he's doing right now in the transition process is very much an extension of what he has been doing for years. And, you know, the dinner with Mitt Romney, of course, that was a very, very public event. The continuous tweeting that he's been doing, for which he's received some substantial criticism because some have said that he gets his facts wrong and tweets information out and then has to either pull it back or just leave it as it is, unfactual. So, you know, again, Donald Trump was not a conventional candidate for the presidency, and he is not a conventional president-elect. And so whatever expectations people had coming into this process, based on how past presidents have come into the office of the presidency, I think simply don't apply to Donald Trump, and he's perfectly proud to be completely different than all of his predecessors.
Well, another thing, looking at the potential selection of Mitt Romney, Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, seemed to indicate that, you know, she was quite negative, she and certain other Trump advisors, because of Romney's earlier, you know, disavowal of and real criticism of Trump's candidacy. It sort of showed a spotlight into some internal potential arguments within the Trump transition team over who should get this job.
Right. And that's another unusual aspect of this transition process, the fact that there has been some amount of internal tension over who the president-elect is considering for various posts, particularly for Secretary of State. and that his own campaign manager and now very close advisor during the transition, Kellyanne Conway, went public with her position against the possibility of Mitt Romney being appointed as the Secretary of State. So usually with conventional politicians, you have a much more close-knit situation where the president-elect and the various people close to him stick to a line. They have a public position on various issues or possible candidates, and they repeat each other. And you don't see this kind of discord, and to the extent that there is any difference of opinion, it's expressed internally and not through the media. Well, the Trump transition has simply taken apart that entire dynamic, and now we have, of course, people within the transition process disagreeing with each other, doing so openly, and the president-elect and his people saying, well, that's perfectly fine. This shows that we're open-minded, we're willing to tolerate dissent and hear out different points of view, and this is the way we intend to do things. So again, very, very different.
Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Scarr School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. And Andrew, I know you've got more news about Mr. Trump today.
Yes. Time magazine every year, they announce around this time their person of the year. And that honor this year goes to Donald Trump, of course, for winning the U.S. presidential election and really dominating the media conversation for the past year. Now, Trump supporters have taken to social media and are praising this, saying it's a great honor that he's being honored with this. Trump's opponents, however, are pointing out that it's not the person who's most liked or most popular. It's the most newsworthy person of the year is how Time makes this determination. And they're pointing to two people who have previously received the honor, Hitler and Stalin, saying that they were previous Time People of the Year. Obviously not great people, to say the least. So they're saying that it doesn't necessarily mean that he's a good person or a popular person. It just means he's newsworthy. And another newsworthy topic today, of course, as you mentioned at the top of the show, the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago today. So we're seeing a lot of tributes on social media with hashtag Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. And two I found particularly interesting. One, a gentleman by the name of Doris Miller, went by Dory Miller. He was a cook on one of the ships that was in Pearl Harbor. And when they came under attack, he went up and grabbed a gun and was trying to shoot down the Japanese planes as they were coming in. And he actually became, because of his heroics, the first African-American to receive the Navy Cross. So a lot of tributes mentioning him today and his heroic story, really a fascinating story. The other thing I saw was the USS Arizona, of course, that famous ship that sank in Pearl Harbor where the Pearl Harbor Memorial is in Hawaii. Their Twitter account, at USS Arizona, is actually live tweeting the events of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and they're giving you a very comprehensive look at what happened. They're telling you at this point in time, in real time, this was the point at which the planes took off from Japan. This is the point at which they were flying over the Pacific. So you can follow along with that on Twitter at USS Arizona and see how the attacks unfolded in real time.
And just think, Twitter wasn't even around in 1941.
Most certainly not. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Officials declare a 2-week state of emergency in Indonesia after the earthquake. There are increasing calls for an immediate ceasefire in Aleppo, Syria. The governor of Iowa has been selected to be the U.S. ambassador to China, and forces retake a Somali town held by the pro-Islamic State fighters. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Belgian scientists say data from NASA's Cassini mission has provided evidence of an ocean deep beneath the surface of Saturn's moon Dione. With this finding, Dione joins its siblings Titan and Enceladus, as well as Jupiter's moon Europa, in the group of moons having a subsurface ocean. The study authors say that gravity data gathered during recent flybys by Cassini suggests Dione's icy crust floats on an ocean several tens of kilometers deep, some 100 kilometers below its surface. The study also proposes that Dione's ocean surrounds a large rocky core. Study authors suggest interactions between the ocean and the moon's rocky core could have long provided the essential ingredients needed to host microbial life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear the latest release by the Danish music group Lucas Graham. China has called on the United States to turn down any requests by Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen for transit through the U.S. to Guatemala when she visits the Central American nation next month. A U.S. State Department spokesman Monday said granting such a transit request has been part of longstanding U.S. practice for the safety, comfort, and convenience of the Taiwan leader. It's the latest development in a dispute sparked by President-elect Donald Trump's decision to accept a congratulatory phone call from the Taiwan leader last Friday. That prompted a strong protest from Beijing and warnings of dire consequences to bilateral ties in Chinese state-run media. Speaking Tuesday to the Washington Post and other media outlets, Ms. Tsai downplayed her phone call, saying it should not be seen as a significant shift in the U.S. one-China policy, which since 1979 has recognized Beijing as the sole representative of the Chinese nation. She added that we all see the value of stability in the region. The associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication The Diplomat, Ankit Panda, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Taiwan leader's position is the correct one.
Essentially, the status quo, which is complicated, but I can go into more detail on that, has been beneficial to the United States, to China, and to Taiwan. And I don't think that there is a serious attempt, at least on the part of either the United States under the incoming administration or the Tsai administration, to seriously upend the status quo. And by seriously upend, I mean Taiwan making a move towards either de jure independence, legal independence, which would be a red line for China, potentially sparking conflict, or for the United States to consider either reestablishing diplomatic ties with Taiwan or significantly increasing its military support for Taipei or offering assurances that Washington would back Taiwan in the case that Taiwan unilaterally wanted to declare independence.
And, Kit, are you surprised by the extent and depth of the Chinese negative reaction to this phone call?
Not surprised at all, actually. I should note, though, that I was a little taken aback by the foreign ministry's fairly muted reaction to the phone call. The Chinese foreign ministry effectively blamed Taiwan for playing a little trick and didn't directly or publicly address the incoming U.S. administration. However, the foreign ministry spokesperson strongly implied that the Chinese side had gotten in contact with Trump's team about the phone call. The reaction in China more broadly is unsurprising. Taiwan is effectively seen as a sovereign piece of Chinese territory, according to the Beijing government, and the Chinese public sees this as a very sore point of nationalist pride.
Well, this story has legs. China on Tuesday called on U.S. officials not to allow the Taiwan president next month to pass through the U.S. en route to Guatemala, one of its few diplomatic allies. Could this also possibly pose a problem, especially Mr. Trump being in New York?
It could pose a problem, yes. Obviously, the fact that the Chinese have made that request of the current administration also puts the United States in this very strange position where you'll have an outgoing government. I believe this is taking place before the inauguration or scheduled to take place before the inauguration. You'll have an outgoing president and the president-elect essentially potentially quarreling over an important issue of foreign policy. In the past, Taiwanese presidents, while they don't carry out formal visits in the United States, are permitted generally to stage layovers. The Trump team would be very strongly against the United States acquiescing to this specific Chinese demand not to allow Tsai to have a customary layover. But I think this will be one of the issues. There'll be a bellwether again of where the Trump administration plans to take U.S. ties with Taiwan.
That's Ankit Panda of The Diplomat. And 70-year-old six-term Iowa Governor Terry Branstad has been picked by Mr. Trump to be the next U.S. ambassador to Beijing. President Xi Jinping, described by Branstad as a longtime friend, visited Iowa in 2012. Today is the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. 5 years ago, I spoke with survivor Charles Ellis of Jacksonville, Florida, about the attack. Ellis was then a 19-year-old seaman on board the battleship USS Pennsylvania at the time of the attack. He recounted what happened.
Many Japanese planes came in. They were coming in from all directions, and there was a lot of them because they were... And all in all, in that first wave of Japanese airplanes, there was about 183 or something like that airplanes. So there was a lot of airplanes. But not only were they attacking Pearl Harbor, but they were attacking the other bases, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps bases all around the island of Oahu. So there were quite a few, but they seemed to, like they congregated on Pearl Harbor, and they were coming in from all directions.
Now, did you know right away they were Japanese?
So they were coming in so low that you couldn't miss them with that red insignia on them.
In the days beforehand, or soon beforehand, was there a threat by the Japanese? Had you been alerted to that there might be an attack, or there was perhaps some concern about growing hostility between the two countries?
Well, see, being a seaman on the ship, they wouldn't tell us anything anyhow. But there was no indication of any problem.
That's Charles Ellis. He was a survivor of Pearl Harbor. He spoke to me in 2011 about the attack. He died 2 years ago at the age of 92. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A popular Danish group has released a new song about family relationships. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London tells me about the new single.
The Grammy nominations were announced this past week. And in the Song of the Year and Record of the Year category, you'll find newcomers Lucas Graham. This is a band that comes from Copenhagen and put out their first album in 2012. But the new album, which is called The Blue Album, was released last year. And with it came the big hit 7 Years. And that's the song that's in the Record of the Year, Song of the Year category, going against Beyonce and Rihanna and all the regulars you'd expect to be in those big categories. Now, Lucas Graham are actually led by a guy whose name is Lucas Graham Forchhammer.
And okay.
He's the lead singer. He became a father this year for the first time. Very nice guy. They are a very soft-spoken group of guys and love their sound, love their style. Now, Lucas Graham Forchhammer, who wrote most of the music, said that the album and the songs on the new album, the Blue Album, are inspired by his relationship with his father. And if you listen to the lyrics of 7 Years, it's a very touching song, and it's a tribute to the memories that he shared with his dad. And his fond memories at age 7, because if, you know, you put the song together, 7 years. The second one was a hit called Mama Said. But today we're going to listen to the third single from their album. This is brand new from Lucas Graham, and it's a song called You're Not There.
I only got you in my stories, and you know I tell them right. I remember you and I when I'm awake at night. So give it up for fallen glory. I never got to say goodbye. I wish I could ask for just a bit more time.
All right, well Larry, what's the background to this song? Why did they write this?
Well, all of the songs on the album are inspired by relationships. Most of them are Lucas Graham Forchhammer's relationship with his father. And that was the story behind the success of the song 7 Years. He became a dad this year. Lucas Graham had his first child. And this is all about relationships with his girlfriend. They haven't yet wed. With his new baby at home. With the father who passed away. And his relationship with his mother as well. The song is called You're Not There. And it talks about the fact that he misses his father. And his father was not around for much of his success, much of his life later on. This is the band's second album, and obviously Dad passed away even before the first album came out. It was a number of years ago. So it's a very heartfelt, very sensitive, very emotional album, and the songs are all kind of autobiographical, very true and inspired by Lucas Graham Forchhammer's relationship with his now-deceased father. And it's earned him, as I mentioned earlier, several Grammy nominations, but that's not it. He also was nominated for quite a few MTV awards in Europe and in the United States as well. So they are a hot band to watch. They're one of the newcomers on the music scene here in the United States.
Are they touring?
They are on tour right now, as a matter of fact, in the U.S., and I've got a request in for an interview. So hopefully that'll come through and I'll be able to feature them on Border Crossings. But for now, we get their music and we get to enjoy the sound of Lucas Graham.
Thanks very much. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. You're not there to celebrate the man that you made. You're not there to share in my success and mistakes. Is it fair? You'll never know the person I'll be. You're not there with me. And that's music from the group Lucas Graham. And that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 3 years since the Russian Federation occupied and sought to annex Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. In response to Russia's illegal aggression against Ukraine, the United States, the European Union, and a number of other countries applied targeted sanctions against Russian individuals, businesses, and officials. As a result, dozens of individuals and entities have been designated by the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, which means U.S. persons are generally prohibited from conducting business with them. Likewise, many assets these specifically designated nationals, or SDN, may have under the jurisdiction of the United States or in the control of U.S. persons are frozen. In mid-November, the Treasury Department added 6 new names to the SDN list, individuals who purportedly represent Crimea and the city of Sebastopol in the Russian State Duma. Thus, Dmitry Belik, Andrei Kozenko, Konstantin Bakarov, Svetlana Savchenko, Ruslan Balbek, and Pavel Shapirov have been designated under Executive Order 13660 for actions or policies that undermine democratic processes and institutions in Ukraine, as well as for actions or policies that threaten the peace, security, and stability, sovereignty, or territorial integrity of Ukraine. Belik, Kozenko, Bakarev, and Savchenko were elected to the Russian State Duma, representing 1-seat constituencies in Crimea and Sevastopol. Balbek was elected to the Russian State Duma as part of the United Russian Political Party ticket, along with Natalia Poklonskaya and Mikhail Sheremet, who was sanctioned 2 years ago. Shapirov, a member of the Liberal Democratic Party, was seated on the Russian State Duma after a United Russian Party member declined the seat. The United States does not recognize the illegitimate elections to the Russian State Duma that took place in Crimea, said John Smith, acting director of OFAC. The Treasury Department's action, he said, was closely coordinated with the European Union, underscoring the strength of the U.S.-EU partnership in maintaining pressure on Russia until it respects the security and sovereignty of Ukraine. The Treasury Department will continue to sanction individuals and entities involved in Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea and its destabilizing activities in Ukraine until Russia ceases violating Ukrainian sovereignty and adheres to its commitments under the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.